The headlines this hour. Iran's president says the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal is tied to the U.S. removing the obstacles it created in the first place. Stern warning from Hamas ahead of the Jewish New Year. Continued Israeli incursions into the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque could spark a major battle. Also ahead, Britain's economy is already in a recession, with the Bank of England increasing interest rates to the highest in nearly a decade and a half.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us.
The Iranian president says obstacles which are impeding the revival of the 2015 Iran deal should be removed by those who have created them. Speaking to a number of U.S. foreign policy experts in New York, Ebrahim Raisi said that Iran has not withdrawn from the agreement and has lived up to its commitments under the accord. Rather, he stressed it was Washington that unilaterally pulled out of the deal, and it is the Europeans that are reneging on their obligations. He said that Tehran approves of talks with the aim of reaching a just and logical outcome. Meanwhile, the Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who is accompanying President Raisi in his New York trip, told his Irish counterpart, Simon Coveney, that Tehran is ready for a good and lasting agreement during talks in Vienna on the revival of the JCPOA. He also urged the U.S., as well as Britain, France, and Germany, to be realistic and to show the will to lift sanctions on Iran. Political commentator Abbas Aslani says Washington's refusal to return to full compliance with the JCPOA is among the main obstacles to the revival of the agreement.
I think one of the major impediments for revival of the nuclear deal is that the Biden administration is not ready to return to the full compliance with the terms of the nuclear deal because they were somehow hesitant about, let's say, appeasing those opponents about returning to the nuclear deal. And now that they are facing a midterm election in the United States, they cannot make a decision whether to return or not. So that has been one of the major obstacles along the way as of the beginning of the talks so far. So, and that's why Iranian president in his meetings in New York somehow referred to that Americans' decision is needed for revival of the, the nuclear deal.
As tensions grow in parts of the West Asia region, a senior Iranian military commander warns that his country will not tolerate any redrawing of frontiers.
As we have stated many times, we will not tolerate changes in the borders of the countries of the region, and we advise the countries of Azerbaijan and Armenia to solve their problems through dialogue. We will not tolerate the change of the borders with war, and we will not remain silent.
General Baghdadi's words came as the two South Caucasus countries have seen deadly clashes at their border this month. The Iranian commander also urged Persian Gulf Arab states to remain on the watch for any seditious moves by Israel. The top general said that Iran will strongly confront Zionist elements and their supporters in case of any threats from them. He said that the U.S. and Israel pose threats to regional security and expressed hope no such security threats will exist in the future. General Baghdadi made the remarks during a military parade marking Iran's Sacred Defense Week. The Iranian Health Ministry says 61 ambulances have been destroyed during the recent riots in several cities in the country. The ministry said the move disrupted emergency health services and the treatment process of patients. It described the attacks on ambulances as an inhumane act and demanded that rioters be held accountable. The riots began a few days ago, with rioters blocking streets and vandalizing public property, as well as police vehicles and ambulances. At least two security forces were killed while trying to confront the rioters. Meanwhile, riots erupted in several Iranian cities after a 22-year-old woman named Mahsa Amini died on Friday in the hospital days after she was taken into a police station. Police later released the CCTV footage of Amini. The video shows the woman suddenly collapsing on the ground in the police station and then later being brought to an ambulance. Tehran Police Commander Hossein Rahimi has rejected claims that she was mistreated, saying that no physical contact happened between officers and Amini. Officials have given assurances that a thorough investigation is underway into her death. Political commentator Kevin Barrett says the West has incited rioters in Iran by waging propaganda operations via social media.
The picture we're getting here in the West right now is part of a propaganda operation, and that propaganda operation probably involves manipulating and inciting these rioters. This reminds us of what happened back after former President Ahmadinejad was elected a little over a decade ago, and we had a weaponized color revolution being orchestrated out of the same Langley, Virginia, CIA-type forces that overthrew the Democratic government under Mossadegh in 1953. And by now, they've gotten really good at using social media to create rent-a-mobs, a little bit like the rent-a-mobs they created in 1953 to overthrow the Iranian government by way of their bribing mobsters in South Tehran to bring a bunch of thugs and rioters into the streets. And now they can do it through social media. Gene Sharp led the methodology, the study for how to manipulate people and try to get young, disaffected, usually males, to act out their testosterone impulses by manipulating them, by giving them certain kinds of images and cues and signals and symbols through social media. So we have to keep in mind that this is not just purely an internal Iranian affair, that undoubtedly these rioters have been egged on in ways that they're probably even unaware of through advanced public relations or mind control techniques of the kind developed by Edward Bernays through the social media. The U.S. government is putting billions of dollars into these efforts to try to destabilize Iran, and I think we're seeing some of the results.
A young girl has been fatally shot during a live fire drill by the U.S. military near the Iraqi capital Baghdad. 15-year-old Zainab Essam al-Ghazali was hit by a bullet which originated from the Victoria military base near Baghdad International Airport. An Iraqi security source says that a probe has been launched into the murder, which is being described as a random shooting. Asaib al-Haq, a political group, has called the U.S. military action a flagrant breach of Iraqi sovereignty. The U.S. invaded the Arab country in 2003 to oust the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but Washington continues to maintain its troops there under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Iraqis have repeatedly expressed their opposition to the U.S. military presence in the country, calling for them to leave. We talked to Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, about the U.S. killing of the Iraqi teen. He believes the death of Zainab Essam al-Ghazali is rooted in the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
It's an awful reminder of the consequences of this almost 20-year-long U.S. occupation in Iraq. And, of course, the shooting happened just near the infamous torture center that the Americans set up in Abu Ghraib. Now, this young girl wasn't even born when the invasion in 2003 took place, but she's the latest of hundreds of thousands of victims of this U.S. occupation. And, unfortunately, we have to recognize that one of the key features of any foreign occupation is there will be no accountability. We can be certain that there won't be accountability in Iraq because that's the nature of the occupation they've established with the Iraqi government. They're still in Iraq for the same reason that they're in Syria, for the same reason that they had economic sieges on the entirety of West Asia. They are trying to fragment and weaken that whole region to prevent the resistance emerging and creating a strong and prosperous region. They want to weaken and divide people, as empires always do, to try and maintain their own influence in the world. And this is the West Asia is a very important region in between Europe and Asia where the greatest struggles of our time are going on.
Elsewhere in the news, Palestinian resistance movements have condemned reports of the UK relocating its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. A spokesperson for Hamas warned the relocation would not give any legitimacy to the occupying regime. Abdul Latif Kanu said that moving the British embassy to Al-Quds is, quote, flagrant bias towards the Israeli occupation. The Islamic Jihad movement also denounced the reported plan as a, quote, hideous colonial aggression against the Palestinians. On Thursday, Downing Street said Prime Minister Liz Truss has discussed reviewing the current location of the British embassy with Israel's caretaker Prime Minister Yair Lapid. After the former U.S. President Donald Trump moved the American embassy to Al-Quds in 2018, three states have followed suit. That has sparked protests from Palestinian activists around the world. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned against any intrusion by Israeli settlers into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during the Jewish New Year holidays.
We have witnessed the serious Zionist crimes and violations against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We are keeping an eye on the preparations by Zionist groups for the upcoming season of alleged Jewish holidays, during which they disturb and desecrate the Al-Aqsa Mosque and practice Jewish rituals there. The continuation of the Zionist aggression and their brutality against Al-Quds and the holy shrines will be the cause of a major battle that will end with the demise of the occupation.
The Hamas official warned that Tel Aviv would be held fully responsible for the repercussions of any desecration of the mosque. He reiterated Hamas's commitment to protecting the rights of the Palestinian people by, quote, all possible means. Under a 1967 agreement between Israel and Jordan, non-Muslim worship at the compound is prohibited. But Palestinians say that the convention is flouted by Israeli settlers who regularly storm the holy site under the protection of the regime forces. Such provocations usually spark tensions in the occupied territories. The Zionist group has already announced its plan to drastically increase the number of settlers who will visit the compound during the holidays this year. International lawyer Barry Grossman believes the Israeli regime is pursuing a number of objectives by orchestrating settler incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
These incursions on Al-Aqsa have long been a recurring thorn in the side of peaceful Palestinians going there to worship, as is their right. And there seem to be a number of objectives in play here. So on the one hand, of course, there are those who see the whole Mount complex as properly being the location of the Jewish temple, which they hope to rebuild. Notwithstanding, of course, that they have no right or entitlement to do that. There are others, though, I would say, who see this as typically triggering a response by Palestinians, an understandable response and a measured response, which in turn is used by the occupation to wage a military offensive and essentially take the fight to Palestinians, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. And then I suppose at the third level, I see this as being part of the ongoing attempt, which has obviously had gained great momentum since Trump was president, to break away from the notion that Jerusalem needs to be maintained as a sort of international protectorate that isn't under the exclusive governance of any one nation in Egypt.
Britons have been feeling the squeeze of the cost of living crisis. Now the Bank of England has confirmed that the country is in a recession as it raises key interest rates. The Bank of England raised the rates to 2.2%, which is a 14-year high. It also projects the country's economy will shrink by 0.1% in the third quarter. The bank says the contraction is due to the public holiday for Queen Elizabeth's funeral, combined with a low second quarter output. It says these factors meet the definition of a recession. It is the bank's seventh consecutive rate hike as it tries to tame soaring prices. The BOE predicts that inflation will peak at under 11% in October. Britain's inflation stands at 9.9%, remaining the highest in nearly four decades. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has called for a mass mobilization of reservists to serve the army in the Ukraine war. To the West, which has been angered by the move, this signals Russia is in trouble. However, Putin sees it in another light. He believes this is needed to guard border regions with Ukraine. Regions in eastern and southern Ukraine recently announced a referendum plans to become parts of Russia.
As the war in Ukraine drags on, Russia announces its intent to intensify its military operation there. President Putin has now announced a partial mobilization of Russia's military forces. Putin said the defense ministry had recommended drawing military reservists into active service as the country faces a protracted conflict in Ukraine and Donbas. Putin says the measure is necessary because Russia is fighting, quote, the entire Western military machine in Ukraine. Putin further accused Ukraine of backing away from a deal that was in the making to end the war. After certain compromises were reached, Kiev received a de facto direct order to derail all agreements. More weapons were pumped into Ukraine. The Kiev regime deployed more gangs of international mercenaries and nationalists, military units trained to NATO standards, and under de facto command of Western advisors. Putin is referring to negotiations that gained momentum following the start of the war back in February, but the West, headed by the United States, pressured Kiev to quit the talks. The West saw the war as an opportunity to contain Russia. In other words, the United States and its allies capitalized on Moscow's moves in Ukraine to settle their long-running differences with the Kremlin. They then began pouring military hardware into East Europe and Ukraine in particular. The United States has already given billions of dollars of military aid to Ukraine and encouraged the leaders in Ukraine to keep up the fight at the expense of their own people. Ukraine has now turned into a battleground used by the United States and its allies in their fight against Russia.
The referendums are for the four regions of Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. It may indicate a move to annex territories, but it is an assumed fact that those regions will become part of Russia. And as such, Moscow will defend the territories as Russia's own, which would spell another headache for the West and could prove there would be no end in sight to the war. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Little Layan Ashar, the recent child victim of the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza, is a clear instance that the fabricated regime of Israel feels free in committing crimes against humanity. The Zionist regime, which is after ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, don't care if its victims are as young as Layan or old and disabled. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Electronic Intifada described the story of Layan in this way. It was a scorching afternoon in Gaza. Layan Ashar, 10, wanted to play on the seashore. It was her idea that we go to the beach, Layan's mother, Hala, said. She was so excited. I want to have a trip to the beach before I go back to school, Layan told me. Using a van rented from a neighbor, several members of the extended family set off from where they live in Khan Yunis area. Musleh, Layan's father, stayed at home. Recalling how he waved at Layan as the van drove off, Musleh said, I didn't know that this would be the last time I would see the smile of my little girl. Soon after they had set out, a missile was fired at a truck from an Israeli regime drone. The Zionist regime had begun a major attack against Gaza on that day, August 5. My children and their cousins were chatting and singing, Hala, Layan's mother said. Then, in the blink of an eye, there was an explosion and the van's floor was covered in blood. Realizing that Layan had been badly injured, her cousin Kemal got out of the van and hailed a passing car. Its driver brought Layan to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Musleh, Layan's father, received a phone call from Hala, his wife. She was so shocked that Musleh had trouble grasping what she was saying. Musleh said, I was just able to understand that the truck was hit in an Israeli strike and that Layan was severely wounded. Layan spent a number of days at a European hospital. For the most of that time, the Zionist regime kept on bombarding Gaza. As her condition deteriorated, her father insisted that she should be taken outside Gaza for specialized treatments unavailable inside the strip. On August 9th, Layan was driven in an ambulance to Maqasid Hospital in occupied East Al-Quds. Layan's mother accompanied her. Mostly her father sought a travel permit from the occupied territories so that he could join them in Al-Quds. He was unable to get the documentation in time. 2 days later, Layan died. Mosleh said, "I wanted to see Layan before she died, but I couldn't. This has broken my heart." Layan was among 17 children killed because of the Zionist regime's attack on Gaza last month. The Zionist regime knows that it can terrorize Palestinians without being held into account. The Zionist regime authorities even tried to avoid being blamed for some of the deaths. For example, the Zionist regime's military initially claimed that a rocket misfired by Islamic Jihad caused the deaths of 5 children in Al-Fallujah Cemetery, northern Gaza, on August 7th. Later that month, the Zionist regime admitted that it killed the 5 children. Defense for Children International Palestine has established that the Zionist regime directly killed 3 other Palestinian children in airstrikes during the August offensive. The organization's assessment was published shortly before Layan Ashar's death was announced. Al-Haq, another Palestinian human rights group, has documented how the Israeli regime repeatedly targeted the homes of civilians last month, including many homes where children lived. Targeting civilian homes and infrastructure violates the principle of distinction, enshrined in the Rome Statute of International Criminal Court. That principle requires warring parties to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. Al-Haq has contended that the Israeli regime's use of drones and other weapons against civilian buildings may amount to war crimes. Layan Ashar will be remembered forever. Middle East Eye also wrote, Layan Ashar-10 becomes the 48th Palestinian victim of the 3-day Israeli regime assault. She became the 48th Palestinian victim of the Zionist regime's military assault on the Gaza Strip, which included 4 women and 17 children. Another 360 Palestinians, including 151 children, were wounded, and some remain at risk of losing their lives. The Palestinian Health Ministry said that Shaer had been hit by shrapnel that damaged vital areas in her brain. On August 5th, the Zionist regime launched a 3-day attack on Gaza before an Egyptian brokered ceasefire came into effect on August 7th. On August 9th, 4 Palestinians were killed by Israeli regime fire in the occupied West Bank, including senior resistance Ibrahim al-Nablusi and 2 children. Hossein Jamal Taha, 16, and Mo'amen Yasin Jaber, 17. Since the start of the year, the Zionist regime forces have killed more than 130 Palestinians, including at least 34 children, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is the way of life a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the member you are listening to. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
Tonight, inshallah, I want to speak a little bit about the Holy Prophet. Who is the one that knows him the best? None other than Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wasalam. So there's no doubt that one place at least that we can go to learn about the Holy Prophet is to Ali ibn Abi Talib. Three things I want to talk about, inshallah, from Nahj al-Balagha. The Prophet's origins in Nahj al-Balagha. In Farsi, we have a saying, Sali kenikust as baharash peydast. Yes, you can tell the year is going to be a good year from the spring. If the spring is good, it's just a Farsi saying. It might not always be true because COVID taught us otherwise, right? But you can tell a year is good from the beginning of it, the way things start, right? So the origins of the Holy Prophet. When you look at the origins of the Holy Prophet, you're like, okay, you can tell there's something special going on. But Ali tells us of those origins. That's one thing we want to talk about. All right, let's go. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The Prophet's origins in Nahj al-Balagha. Sermon number 94. فَاسْتَوْدَعَهُمْ فِي أَفْضَلِ مُسْتَوْدَعَ وَأَقَرَّهُمْ فِي خَيْرِ مُسْتَقَرَ. The Imam, he says, Allah kept the Prophets in deposit, in the best place of deposit, before they were born, or when they were being born, and made them stay in the best place of stay. He moved them in succession from distinguished forefathers to chaste wombs. I'll talk about this later. Whenever a predecessor from among them died, the follower, the one that came after, the one who succeeded, stood up for the cause of the religion of Allah. Okay, so he's talking about the prophets in general, correct? So this applies to our prophet too, yes, but then he makes it a point to speak about the prophet in particular. Ali makes a point. He goes on, hatta afdat karamatullah subhanahu ila Muhammadin sallallahu alayhi wa alihi fa akhrajahu min afdalil ma'adini manbitan wa a'azzil ulumati maghrisa. And he goes on, until this distinction of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the glorified, reached Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi and his descendants. Allah brought him out from the most distinguished sources of origin and the most honorable places of planting. Planting, you plant a seed? Yeah. Sometimes you can plant a seed in a fertile ground, sometimes in a barren ground. I've seen it the land of Shamat and in Lebanon and Syria and those places. If you go, you'll see some places that the dirt and soil is like almost black. That's how rich it is. Anything you plant in there, even if you stand there for 5 minutes, something's going to probably grow out of you. You know, that's how fertile it is. And then there are some places like where we're living, or even worse, other places where no matter what you do, you can't grow a single plant, right? Here, he actually says a planting area to really illustrate for us that Allah is actually doing some work here, planting something and trying to yield fruit and result from it. All right. So he says, the most honorable places of planting, namely from the same lineal tree from which he brought forth other prophets. Now we know why he called it the planting. Because there's a tree, a lineage that goes back to who? Goes back to previous prophets. From which he selected his trustees. Muhammad's descendants are the best descendants, his kinsmen the best of kin, and his lineal tree the best of trees. It grew in esteem and rose in distinction. It has tall branches and unreachable fruits. Yeah. If you've gone to these orchards, sometimes you're picking the fruit, you see those big fat cherries at the top. They're big fat cherries at the top because no one else could reach them. You can't either. That's why they're still there intact. Right? These descendants of the Holy Prophet, also they're the fruit. Imam Ali Nahj al-Balagha, he refers to himself as the fruit of the tree. You know when? Saqifa. When they said that the first and second Khalifa are from Quraysh and that the bay'ah should be given to them, they argued with what? With the tree of Quraysh. What does Imam Ali say? He says, ihtajju bil shajara wa adaa'u thamara. They argued with the tree. They made an argument with the tree, which is Quraysh. But wait a minute, there is a fruit at the top of this tree that you all cannot reach, and that is at the thamara of this tree, which was the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. And so adaa'u al-thamara, they forgot the fruit of the tree, they lost the fruit of the tree. Yes, there is a tree with fruit, and this fruit is not attainable for everybody. I can't say like, I want to be one of those fruits. No. These are unreachable fruits. Unreachable, I would say, in the sense of you can't be one of them. You can make the most of that fruit, but you can't be one of them. It's unattainable. Isma and infallibility, in that sense, we believe, is something that Allah blesses certain individuals with. So here, the Imam is making a point that yes, the family tree, the lineage plays a role. Does it play the entire role? Well, let me make that disclaimer right now. No, it doesn't. You know why? What's the best example of a Hashemite who is going to be in Jahannam for sure because the Quran said so? Who's that? Abu Lahab. The uncle of the Prophet. Uncle of the Prophet. Brother of Abdullah. Brother of Abbas. This individual is a Hashemite. He's from the Bani Hashim. Did being from the Bani Hashim help him? No. Why? Because the Quran said so. I mean, if you're going to have a surah of the Quran named after you, make sure it's in a positive way, not in a negative one. You know? Hey people, my name's in the Quran. Yeah, but look what it's saying about you. Tabbat yada abi lahabin wa tab. May your hands be cut. And your wife. Both of y'all going to hell. So lineage doesn't always play a role, but for sure it's part of the reason why people like this, you will not have a tree of mushrikeen and then all of a sudden a prophet emerged. We're not saying that everyone's going to go to Jahannam if they come from a certain tree. Let's get this right. But those chosen elite individuals that are going to be prophets, usually, if not always, let me correct that, always when you look at the tree, you will find they come from a tree of Tawheed, to the point that mainstream Shia believes that when Prophet Ibrahim in the Quran says, my father, oh Allah, forgive my father for his shirk, that wasn't his actual biological father. That was the man that raised him. But it wasn't his actual biological father. Yes, so this is a mainstream Shia belief that yes, if you want one of these awliyaullah, they will come as a result of that tree. But yes, lineage will not do all the work for you. قَالَ وَمِن دُرِّيَّتِي قَالَ لَا يَنَالُ عَهْدِ الظَّالِمِينَ. Prophet Ibrahim, in the Quran, when he is made an imam after he was already prophet for God knows how long, he sees how awesome this position is of imamat that he has now. He says, oh Allah, for my descendants, I wish this for my descendants. لَا يَنَالُ عَهْدِ الظَّالِمِينَ. There are going to be some of your descendants who have committed sins in their life. It won't reach them. But they're my lineage. Lineage doesn't do all the work for you. But yes, you got to have that at least and other things. And so this is why they say that كُتِبَ لِلنَّبِيِّ عَلَيْهِ الصَّلَاةُ وَالسَّلَامُ 500 أُمَّنْ فَمَا وُجِدَتْ فِيهِنَّ سِفَاحًا وَلَا شَيْئًا مِمَّا كَانَ مِنْ أَمْرِ الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ. That they wrote down the ancestors of the Holy Prophet from his mother's side all the way up. And here it says 500. I'm guessing it's just, you know, to show that as many as there were, they looked through all of these names, they did not find one unchaste woman amongst these women. And anything of jahiliyyah that would taint a woman back then, they didn't find any signs of that. So these are his origins, brothers and sisters, according to Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلى الله عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Over the course of this summer, the nation has been transfixed by the House Select Committee's hearings on the events of 6th of January 2021 and how or whether Donald Trump might face accountability for what happened on that day. The article you're about to hear has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. The piece is titled, Donald Trump is Not Above the Law, and it's been written by the editorial board of the newspaper. Over the course of this summer, America has been transfixed by the House Select Committee's hearings on the events of 6th of January 2021 and how or whether Donald Trump might face accountability for what happened on that day. The Justice Department remained largely silent about its investigations of the former president until this month, when the FBI searched his home in Palm Beach, Florida, in a case related to his handling of classified documents. The spectacle of a former president facing criminal investigation raises profound questions about American democracy, and these questions demand answers. Donald Trump's unprecedented assault on the integrity of American democracy requires a criminal investigation. The disturbing details of his post-election malfeasance, meticulously assembled by the January 6th committee, leave little doubt that Mr. Trump sought to subvert the Constitution and overturn the will of the American people. The president defeated at the polls in 2020 tried to enlist federal law enforcement authorities, state officials, and administrators of the nation's electoral system in a furious effort to remain in power. When all else failed, he roused an armed mob that stormed the Capitol and threatened lawmakers. The Justice Department is reportedly examining Mr. Trump's conduct, including his role in trying to overturn the election and in taking home classified documents. If Attorney General Merrick Garland and his staff conclude that there is sufficient evidence to establish Donald Trump's guilt on a serious charge in a court of law, then they must seek an indictment too. This board is aware that in deciding how Donald Trump should be held accountable under the law, it is necessary to consider not just whether criminal prosecution would be warranted, but whether it would be wise. No American president has ever been criminally prosecuted after leaving office. When President Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, he ensured that Nixon would not be prosecuted for crimes committed during the Watergate scandal. Gerald Ford explained his decision with the warning that such a prosecution posed grave risks of rousing ugly passions and worsening political polarization. That warning is just as salient today. Pursuing prosecution of Donald Trump could further entrench support for him and play into the conspiracy theories he has sought to stoke. It could inflame the bitter partisan divide, even to the point of civil unrest. A trial, if it is viewed as illegitimate, could also further undermine confidence in the rule of law, whatever the eventual outcome. The risks of political escalation are obvious, The Democratic and Republican parties are already in the thick of a cycle of retribution that could last generations. There is a substantial risk that, if the Justice Department does prosecute Donald Trump, future presidents, whether Mr. Trump himself or someone of his ilk, could misuse the precedent to punish political rivals. If their party takes a majority in the House of Representatives after the midterm elections, some Republicans have already threatened to impeach President Biden. There is an even more immediate threat of further violence, and it is a possibility that Americans should, sadly, be prepared for. In the hours after federal agents began a quarter-proof search of Donald Trump's residence in Palm Beach, based on a warrant investigating possible violations of three federal laws, including one that governs the handling of defense information under the Espionage Act, his most fervent supporters escalated their rhetoric to the language of warfare. As the New York Times noted, the aggressive widespread response was arguably the clearest outburst of violent public rhetoric since the days leading up to the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol. Merrick Garland has been deliberate, methodical, and scrupulous in his leadership of the Justice Department's investigation of the January 6 attack and the transfer of documents to Donald Trump's home. On Friday, a redacted version of the affidavit used to obtain the warrant was released, revealing that the Justice Department asked to search the premises to recover documents because of concerns that their disclosure could compromise clandestine human sources of intelligence, and because it had probable cause to believe it would find evidence of obstruction at the premises. No matter how careful Merrick Garland is, or how measured the prosecution might be, there is a real and significant risk from those who believe that any criticism of Donald Trump justifies an extreme response. Yet, it is a far greater risk to do nothing when action is called for. Aside from letting Mr. Trump escape punishment, doing nothing to hold him accountable for his actions in the months leading up to the January 6 assault could set an irresistible precedent for future presidents. Why not attempt to stay in power by any means necessary or use the power of the office to enrich oneself or punish one's enemies, knowing that the law does not apply to presidents in or out of office? More importantly, democratic government is an ideal that must constantly be made real. America is not sustained by a set of principles. It is sustained by resolute action to defend those principles. Immediately after the January 6 insurrection, cabinet members reportedly debated privately whether to remove Donald Trump from power under the authority of the 25th Amendment. A week after the attack, the House impeached Mr. Trump for the second time. This editorial board supported his impeachment and removal from office. We also suggested that the former president and lawmakers who participated in the January 6 plot could be permanently barred from holding office under a provision of the 14th Amendment that applies to any official who has engaged in insurrection or rebellion, or given aid or comfort to those who have done so. But most Republicans in the Senate refused to convict Donald Trump, and Congress has yet to invoke that section of the 14th Amendment against him. As a result, the threat that Donald Trump and his most ardent supporters pose to American democracy has metastasized. Even now, the former president continues to spread lies about the 2020 election and denounce his vice president, Mike Pence, for not breaking the law on his behalf. Meanwhile, dozens of people who believe Mr. Trump's lies are running for state and national elected office. Many have already won, some of them elevated to positions that give them control over how elections are conducted. In June, the Republican Party in Texas approved measures in its platform declaring that Mr. Biden's election was illegitimate. And Donald Trump appears prepared to start a bid for a second term as president. Mr. Trump's actions as a public official, like no other since the Civil War, attacked the heart of our system of government. He used the power of his office to subvert the rule of law. If we hesitate to call those actions and their perpetrator criminal, then we are saying he's above the law and giving license to future presidents to do whatever they want. In addition to a federal investigation by the Justice Department, Donald Trump is facing a swirl of civil and criminal liability in several other cases. A lawsuit by the Attorney General for the District of Columbia over payments during his inauguration ceremonies. A criminal investigation in Westchester County, New York, over taxes on one of his golf courses. A criminal case in Fulton County, Georgia, over interference in the 2020 presidential election. A criminal case by the Manhattan District Attorney over the valuation of Mr. Trump's properties. And a civil inquiry by New York's Attorney General into Donald Trump and the Trump Organization. The specific crimes the Justice Department could consider would likely involve Mr. Trump's fraudulent efforts to get election officials in Georgia, in Arizona, and elsewhere to declare him the winner, even though he lost in those states. To get Mike Pence, at the 6th of January congressional certification of the election, to throw out slates of electors from states he lost and replace them with electors loyal to Mr. Trump. And to enlist officials from the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, to persuade officials in certain states to swing the election to him and ultimately stir up a mob that attacked the Capitol. The government could also charge Mr. Trump with seditious conspiracy, a serious charge that federal prosecutors have already brought against leaders of far-right militia groups who participated in the Capitol invasion. The committee hearings make it clear Mr. Trump must have known he was at the center of a frantic, sprawling, and knowingly fraudulent effort that led directly to the Capitol siege. For hours, Donald Trump refused to call off the mob. The testimony from hundreds of witnesses, many of them high-ranking Republican officials from his own administration, reveals Donald Trump's unrelenting efforts, beginning months before Election Day and continuing through 6th of January, to sow doubt about the election, to refuse to accept the result of that election, and then to pursue what he must have known were illegal and unconstitutional means to overturn it. Many participants sought preemptive pardons for their conduct, an indication that they knew very well that they were violating the law. Other evidence points to other crimes like obstruction of Congress, defined as a corrupt obstruction of the proper administration of the law. The fake elector scheme that Mr. Trump and his associates pushed before January 6 appears to meet this definition. That may explain why at least three of Mr. Trump's campaign lawyers were unwilling to participate in the plot. People involved in it were told it was not legally sound by White House lawyers, but they move forward with it anyway. Cassidy Hutchinson, a top aide to Mr. Trump's last chief of staff, Mark Meadows, provided powerful evidence that could be used to charge Donald Trump with seditious conspiracy. In her public testimony at a January 6 committee hearing, Cassidy Hutchinson said that Mr. Trump was informed that many in the throng of supporters waiting to hear him speak on the Ellipse on that day were armed, but that he demanded that they be allowed to skip the metal detectors that had been installed for his security. "They're not here to hurt me," he said, according to Ms. Hutchinson. "Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here." If Merrick Garland decides to pursue prosecution, a message that the Justice Department must send early and often is that even if Mr. Trump genuinely believed, as he claimed, that the election had been marred by fraud, his schemes to interfere in the certification of the vote would still be crimes. And even though Mr. Trump's efforts failed, these efforts would still be crimes. More than 850 other Americans have already been charged with crimes for their roles in the Capitol attack. Well-meaning intentions did not shield them from the consequences of their actions. It would be unjust if Donald Trump, the man who inspired them, faced no consequences. No one should revel in the prospect of this or any former president facing criminal prosecution. Donald Trump's actions have brought shame on America and destabilized its future. Even justice before the law will not erase that stain. Nor will prosecuting Mr. Trump fix the structural problems that led to the greatest crisis in American democracy since the Civil War. But it is a necessary first step toward doing so.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyah on August 30th, 2022. Another great achievement you've made is that this government has refrained from blaming others and making excuses. And it has accepted responsibility for the actions it has taken. During this time, we haven't heard any government official say, "They won't let us do anything, we don't have any authority over such and such is out of our hand." We haven't heard these things from you. Accepting responsibility for your actions is truly important. You say, we are here, we need to get the job done, and we will get the job done. This is a very positive, important point. Another important point is that good approaches are being taken in the fields of foreign policy and culture. Now, these approaches, especially in the cultural fields, will take time to be implemented, but there are positive approaches. They need to be followed up. They are another of your accomplishments. The slogans of the revolution have gained emphasis, as have the slogans of Islam. Slogans such as seeking justice, avoiding luxuries, supporting the oppressed, and standing against arrogance. These are the main slogans of the revolution. These matters have been emphasized and been clearer in people's speech, and this is a great thing. Continue with it.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You try to continue with these accomplishments. I shall talk about these more when I am making my recommendations. In any case, consistent work is needed in all fields. This was about the first part, your achievements. As for my recommendations, I have a few suggestions. My first word of advice, which I have given to most of the governments that have been formed in recent years, is that first of all, you should be grateful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for blessing you with the opportunity to serve people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.